It is 2 in the morning, summer of 1948, and a young first lieutenant named Gail Halvorsen is sitting on the flight deck of a C-54 Skymaster somewhere between Rhein-Main Air Base and the rubble of a city that half the world is trying to strangle. Outside the windscreen, there is nothing but black sky and the glow of engine exhaust off the nacelles below him. Somewhere in that dark is Germany. Inside the cargo hold, flour, bags and bags of flour. In about 45 minutes, he is going to thread that airplane through an approach corridor 3 miles wide, descend over apartment buildings with his gear down, and touch down at Tempelhof Airport in the middle of Berlin. The tower is going to give him 30 minutes to offload and get out of the way before the next airplane needs that ramp. And then he is going to turn around and do it again. I'm Taildragger. This is the Hangar on Radio Hangar. And today we're going back to one of the most extraordinary airlifts in aviation history, a mission that was supposed to be impossible. A mission that lasted 462 days, and a mission that produced one of the most unlikely heroes this profession has ever seen. This is the story of Operation Vittles. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation Challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, to understand what happened in Berlin, you have to understand what Berlin was in the summer of 1948. 3 years after the end of World War II, Germany was divided. The Western Allies held the Western zones. The Soviets held the Eastern zone. And sitting right in the middle of the Soviet zone, like an island, was Berlin. The city itself was also divided. West Berlin held by the Western Allies. East Berlin held by the Soviets, a city of 2.5 million people sitting 110 miles inside Soviet-controlled territory. Connected to the West only by a handful of roads, rail lines, and canals. On June 24, 1948, the Soviets closed them all. No trucks, no trains, no barges. Every land route into West Berlin was blocked at every checkpoint. The Soviets issued a statement that could be summarized simply, West Berlin cannot be supplied. West Berlin will be forced to accept Soviet terms. West Berlin in time will be absorbed. The Soviet military governor reportedly told his staff it would be over in 6 weeks. He was not accounting for what was about to happen in the sky. General Lucius Clay was the American military governor of Germany at the time, hard man, West Point, deeply stubborn, and he was not going to surrender West Berlin without a fight. But a physical fight, pushing trucks through Soviet checkpoints, testing the blockade with armor, that risked turning a Cold War into a very hot one. There was another option. Berlin sat under 3 air corridors, 20 miles wide each, negotiated by the Allies in 1945. The Soviets had agreed to those corridors in writing. If the Western Allies were going to supply Berlin by air, they would be doing it within rights that already existed on paper. The question was whether it was physically possible. West Berlin needed a minimum of 4,000 tons of supplies per day just to keep the lights on and the people fed. Coal, flour, meat, dried eggs, baby formula, medicine. 2.5 million people, 4,000 tons a day, every single day, with no end date in sight. At the time, the Americans had roughly 100 C-47 Dakotas available in Europe. The C-47 could carry about 3 tons per flight, even flying around the clock. 100 C-47s couldn't come close to 4,000 tons a day. Military planners told Clay it couldn't be done. Clay told them to start flying anyway. The first airlift flights went in on June 26, 1948. A few dozen C-47s, hauling flour and medicine. It was a gesture more than a solution, but Clay was betting that if they started, they could build from there. Within 2 weeks, the Americans had begun replacing the C-47s with C-54 Skymasters. The C-54 was a 4-engine transport, the military version of the Douglas DC-4. It could carry 10 tons per flight. That was a different airplane entirely. The British were flying in with their own aircraft alongside the Americans, Avro Yorks, Handley Page Hastings and Short Sunderland, flying boats that landed right on the Havel Lake in the middle of the city. Think about that for a moment. Flying boats landing on a lake inside a blockaded city, taxiing up to the shore to offload salt and dried fish. The American operation had a name now, Operation Vittles. The British called theirs Operation Plainfare, and now it comes back to the man on the flight deck. Gail Halvorsen was a 27-year-old Air Force lieutenant from Utah. He had learned to fly during the war, ferrying aircraft across the Atlantic. He was stationed at Brookley Field in Alabama when the airlift started, and he volunteered for Germany by July of 1948. He was flying two and sometimes three round trips a day between Rhein Main and Tempelhof, flour, coal, sometimes fuel. The schedule was relentless. Land, offload, brief rest, take off, do it again. One afternoon on a day off, Halvorsen walked to the perimeter fence at Tempelhof. On the other side, there were about 30 German children, watching the airplanes come in. Not begging, not asking for anything, just watching. He stopped and talked to them through the fence. His German was poor. Their English wasn't much better, but they communicated. These were kids who had grown up under Allied bombing, then Soviet occupation, and now this siege. And what struck Halvorsen was that despite all of it, they were not complaining. They were grateful. Quietly, genuinely grateful for the airplanes. He reached into his pocket. He had two sticks of double mint gum, the only candy he had on him. He broke them each in half and passed the four pieces through the fence. What happened next surprised him more than anything he said he had ever witnessed. The kids who got the gum were careful with it. The kids who didn't get any tore off tiny corners of the wrappers and passed them around so everyone could at least smell it. That moment changed him. He went back to his barracks and started thinking. He was flying over Tempelhof twice a day. He could see the approach from miles out. The kids at the fence could see him coming. Here's the idea he came up with. He had some candy bars and chocolate from the base post exchange. He took his handkerchiefs and tied them into small parachutes. He stuffed the candy inside and rolled them up tight, and the next time he flew the approach into Tempelhof when he passed over that fence, he dropped them out the flare chute in the bottom of the airplane. He told the kids how to know it was him. He would wiggle his wings on final. Rock left, rock right, a signal. That way they would know to watch for the parachutes. They called him Uncle Wiggly Wings. The letters started coming in to Tempelhof Airport, addressed to Uncle Wiggly Wings, or the chocolate pilot, or sometimes just the chocolate flyer. Children were sending handkerchiefs to use as parachutes, drawings, letters in broken English full of misspelled words and perfect gratitude. A little girl named Mercedes Simon wrote, describing exactly where she would be standing. He found her from the air. He dropped candy right on her spot. Now, here is where it gets interesting. Halvorsen had not asked for permission to do any of this. He was dropping objects out of a United States Air Force aircraft onto a foreign city. When his commanding officer found out, Halvorsen thought his career was over. Instead, the story had already reached a newspaper reporter. It was in print. It was on radio broadcasts back in the States. And suddenly, the Air Force did not have a disciplinary problem. It had a public relations gift. The operation got official blessing and an official name, Operation Little Vittles. Candy companies in the United States started donating. The children of Alabama, where Halvorsen had been stationed, collected candy and gum and sent it to Germany. Then it came from all over the country. Halvorsen's crew was making parachutes on their time off, staying up late, cutting and tying handkerchiefs. Other flight crews joined in. Eventually, the program had a full support staff. By the time Operation Little Vittles was finished, they had dropped more than 3 tons of candy over Berlin. 3 tons, parachuted out of American military transport aircraft, one bag at a time, to children standing in the rubble of a city that had been on the other side of a war 3 years earlier.
I have read about a lot of missions in aviation, acts of courage and acts of genius, but I keep coming back to that moment at the fence. 4 pieces of gum and a pilot who thought, I wonder if I could do something about that. Now, the operation surrounding all of this, General William Tunner arrived in Germany in late July of 1948 to take command of the Combined Airlift Task Force. Tunner had run the Hump operation during World War II, flying supplies over the Himalayas from India into China. He knew more about large-scale air logistics than almost anyone alive. What he found when he arrived was organized chaos. Aircraft were stacking over Tempelhof, circling in holding patterns waiting for landing slots. Pilots were going off schedule. Weather diversions were being handled inconsistently. Ramp time was running long. The operation was moving, but it was not moving with the precision Tunner knew it needed. He eliminated the flexibility and turned the whole thing into an assembly line. Under Tunner's system, there were no holding patterns. If you missed your approach slot, you did not circle and try again. You turned around and flew back to West Germany. That was it. The loss of one load of coal was acceptable. The disruption of a stacked approach corridor was not. Aircraft flew specific routes at specific altitudes at specific times. The southern corridor inbound, the northern corridor outbound. Traffic flowing one direction continuously like a conveyor belt. A new airplane touched down at Tempelhof every 3 to 4 minutes. Pilots were briefed on the ground, not in the air. Every decision was made before you climbed in the cockpit. A pilot who landed at Tempelhof got a weather report, a cup of coffee and a donut. That was it, 30 minutes on the ground, then back in the air. The airplane was offloaded, the cargo weighed, and the next crew was climbing aboard before the previous crew had reached the exit gate. It was the most efficient use of airspace and runway capacity that had ever been attempted anywhere in the world.
The blockade lasted 323 days. In that time, the Allied airlift flew more than 200,000 sorties and delivered 2.3 million tons of supplies. Coal made up the largest portion, coal for heat and coal for power plants, enough to keep a city of 2.5 million people alive through a Berlin winter. And Berlin winters are not gentle. The winter of 48 to 49 was brutal. Fog, ice, snow, visibility measured in hundreds of feet. The instrument approaches into Tempelhof were flown over rows of apartment buildings with almost no margin. You were on glide slope or you were not where you needed to be. There was no room to sort it out late. 17 American airmen and 8 British airmen died during the Berlin airlift. Mechanical failures, accidents and poor weather, crashes on approach. Their names are on a memorial at Tempelhof. They did not die in combat. They died hauling flour and coal into a divided city on a mission that the Soviets were sure could not be sustained. The Easter Parade is what they called April 16, 1949. Tunner wanted to demonstrate the absolute maximum capacity of the operation. On that single day, the combined airlift task force flew 1,398 flights and delivered nearly 13,000 tons of cargo into Berlin. One airplane landing at one of the Berlin airfields, roughly every 60 seconds, around the clock, for 24 hours. The Soviets were watching that number. They had never believed the airlift could sustain itself. They had certainly never believed it could grow. But it had grown month by month, from a few dozen C-47s in June of 48 to a machine that could put 13,000 tons on the ground in a single day. On May 12, 1949, the Soviet Union lifted the blockade. West Berlin was never absorbed. The city stayed divided for another 40 years until the wall came down in 1989. But it did not fall in 1948, partly because of Lucius Clay's stubbornness, partly because of William Tunner's genius for logistics, partly because of hundreds of thousands of flights by air crews who just kept showing up and doing the work. And partly because a young lieutenant from Utah handed 4 pieces of gum through a chain-link fence and asked himself whether he could do something about what he had just seen. Gail Halvorsen went on to a distinguished Air Force career. He retired as a colonel. Long after the airlift, he went back to Berlin. Again and again over the decades, he attended reunions. He dropped candy at air shows well into his 80s. He visited the children he had corresponded with, now grown adults with children and grandchildren of their own. Mercedes Simon, the girl he had spotted from the air with her letter, became a lifelong friend. He lived to be 101 years old. Back when Avgas was cheap and airspace was free, we used to argue in the hangar about what this job really was at its core, whether it was skill or nerve or just enough stubbornness to keep going. I think about Gail Halvorsen sometimes when that argument comes back to me. He was not the best pilot on the airlift. He was not the most decorated. He was just a guy who noticed something on the other side of a fence and thought about it long enough to do something. That is not a small thing. My information on Operation Vittles and Gail Halvorsen comes primarily from Andrei Cherny's book, The Berlin Airlift, General William Tunner's Memoir, Over the Hump, and records from the Air Force Historical Research Agency, more at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger. See you next time.